All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. Our order of business today will be first to take care of matters involving House Bill 2797 and then Senate Bill 820. So I will start first by opening a work session on House Bill 2797. Colleagues, you have a -2 amendment in front of you for House Bill 2797, which guts and stuffs this bill with a bill that this committee had previously addressed this session, an Oregon Law Commission bill relating to public bodies. Mr. Kanagi, do you want to come forward and just briefly put on the record that I'm accurate about what I've just said?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. What you have before you in the form of
you need to identify yourself.
Excuse me, Dave Kanagi, Executive Director, Oregon Law Commission. What you have before you is amendment to HB 2797. The substance of that amendment is the same as HB 2278, which came up. Now, here is a difference from what was said a moment ago. Came up through the General Government Committee.
Okay.
And
thank you.
And then through to the floor of the House. It is on the Senate side, and we need a new vehicle to press this bill forward. By history, it is a work of the Oregon Law Commission of some substance that provides an opportunity for uniformity in the definition of public body. Is a matter of law improvement that we urge your support for. Thank you.
Representative Shetterly, as chair of the Law Commission, do you want to comment about the work of the commission on this issue?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This actually is sort of part two. The commission did some preliminary work last session in trying to unify the statutory approach to the definition of public body, and with that then to clarify what laws apply to what bodies. And this is the second step to that. I think I can fairly represent that this is the work of a very broadly representative work group that came into the that introduced the bill into the session. After it was introduced, there was even some further work to refine it that was done while the bill was in possession of the General Government Committee. I believe this passed on the House floor, unanimously? If it didn't, I can't think of any opposition to it on the House floor, and it's just gotten caught up in traffic in the Senate. I think the purpose of this is to give it another run to move it through the Senate. It's a good bill. It's, as far as I know, non-controversial in its substance, and does good work in clarifying law relating to public bodies. Representative Krummel, I know, chaired the General Government Committee, and is probably about as familiar with this as anybody else on the committee.
Representative Krummel, this bill came through your committee, I believe, earlier this session.
2278.
Yeah, in that form it was 2278. This is essentially 2278 redo into 2797. Do you have anything to add, Representative Krummel?
The only thing I would add, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity, is that we found that, and the bill did, in fact, come out of general government on a unanimous vote, and then passed the House, as Representative Shetterly said, with in the 50s to not very many, if anyone opposed it. But it does give some good provisions with regards to public bodies and what their definitions are and that sort of thing. So I think that the bill is, if this is basically the same bill that 2278 was, it would be a good bill. I can tell you that probably the biggest traffic gainer over on the Senate side with 2278 has been the attempt by one of the senators to start putting some undesirable language in there. So even if it were to get out of the Senate, it may face a conference committee coming back to the House. My only other question is, how come we didn't pick a Senate bill to stick this into so that the Senate didn't have to vote on it again?
Yeah, and I think we looked, and the answer was there was no, you know, as good as preserving relating clauses as I try to be, the Senate hadn't sent us anything that worked, so we had to go back to a House bill in order to make it happen.
I know that feeling.
But Representative Krummel, can I take your comments as a motion to move the -2 amendments?
Certainly.
Representative Krummel moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 2797. Is there any discussion on his motion? Is there any objection on the adoption of the dash twos? Hearing none, the twos are in the bill. Representative Crummell?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2797 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Crummell moves House Bill 2797 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, Ann, call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Benson?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Kozanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2797 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Crummell is the former chair of the General Government Committee, or I guess is the chair of that committee that's no longer meeting.
Yeah.
Would you be willing to carry this bill on the floor?
Sure.
Okay. Would appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Carnegie. Yes, and Representative Jensen was excused from the vote. Did you want to be on that vote?
He voted.
Oh, did you vote? Okay. I guess I didn't see you.
I stopped. You came back.
Okay. You're quick. All right, the next one we're going to do is we're going to jump ahead to Senate Bill 820, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 820. Colleagues, this bill has been before us where it was replaced with a couple of bills that had ran into similar kinds of traffic problems in the Senate. On its way to the floor, there were a couple of other bills that people decided they wanted to add into the mix in a bill that has that broad relating clause relating to water, just like the last bill where we're privileged to have the chair of the General Government Committee sit on this committee. We're also privileged to have the chair of the Water Committee on this committee. And with Representative Jensen's approval, we brought the bill back today for the purposes of considering the addition of these amendments, which would pick up two other House bills that had already passed the House, again, with almost unanimous support, as I recall.
Mr. Chair, of the four bills that are in, are proposed, the two that are in and the two that are proposed, of the four bills, there was one no vote on the floor for all four. The two being talked about today, there were both bills passed without a no vote.
Without a no vote. Okay. So,
and they came out of committee the same way with no opposition.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. What I thought I would do is I know Representative Dingfelder's presence in the audience. Do you want to come forward, Representative Dingfelder, and just briefly tell us what the amendments that we're doing, what bills they were that we're now putting into 820 before we send it back to the floor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I can speak to Section 27 of the dash C-13s, and that was previously House Bill 3047. And the other bill was Representative Butler's bill, and I don't know if he's here. Both of those bills, by the way, 3047 and Representative Butler's bill was 3281, passed unanimously out of committee on the House floor, as Representative Jensen has already mentioned. So I can speak to what previously was House Bill 3047, which is now Section 20. Actually, it's 23. As Representative Jensen mentioned, this had a complete airing in the Water Committee several months ago. This section of the bill establishes a state policy on urban wastewater reuse. And the bill, or the section, directs the Department of Environmental Quality to work with interested parties and other state agencies to review barriers to water reuse in urban areas, develop incentives to encourage water reuse, and report back to the 73rd Legislative Assembly on their findings and recommendations. And the reason that this original bill, House Bill 3047, came up, because the demand for water, both potable and non-potable, is continuing to grow as Oregon's population increases. And with this in mind, we need to shift away from thinking of domestic and industrial wastewater as a liability that needs to be disposed of, to seeing it as an asset with favorable uses. And I'm sure that many people are familiar with the use of treated wastewater for crop irrigation, but are less familiar with the use of treated wastewater for other uses, such as irrigating landscaping, golf courses, restoring wetland habitats, and, yes, indoor uses such as flushing toilets. So wastewater reuse can also benefit fish and other aquatic organisms because of the practice of wastewater reuse can augment stream flows by reducing water withdrawal demands for out-of-stream uses. And the reuse of municipal and industrial wastewater can be an important element in a strategy to develop a diverse multi-source approach to meeting the state's growing water supply needs. This bill had no opposition in its current form. We worked with many different groups to make sure that their needs were addressed. The agencies are supportive. And Oregon's committed to wise stewardship of our natural resources for future generations. So I think that this section of the bill makes sense. And I urge your support.
Thank you very much, Representative Dingfelder. Any questions for Representative Dingfelder before we excuse her? Thank you. Representative Frommel.
You're too slow.
Don't go anywhere. My only question is, how long... Let me rethink it. Has it not been state policy in the past to use water reclamation in ways to such as irrigation and that sort of thing up until now? Or has it just been left to the individual communities if they wanted to do that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's an excellent question, and actually I may call upon DEQ to come up and make sure I'm answering correctly. But first of all, one thing I just want to make clear, that my bill only addresses urban water reuse. And there are practices that are currently occurring both in irrigation in non-urban areas, so for agricultural use, and there are some practices occurring in urban areas, but there hasn't been up till now a state policy. And part of what I found, and I've worked with individual constituents who are trying to promote wastewater reuse even on an individual basis within their homes, and there are barriers in existing statutes. Sometimes it's city code, sometimes it's at the state level, and so part of the impetus for doing this is for us to take a holistic look at barriers that do exist in our state rules and regulations to make sure that we don't make it hard for people, and to look at incentives in the future. I mean, obviously, this year with the fiscal crisis, I didn't think it was wise to bring forth a bill that had incentives attached, but that's something in the future we may look to as our demands grow. But I'd like to, Mr. Chair, maybe ask DEQ to come up and address that if you don't feel that
Representative Crummel, do you need that?
No, that's okay. Fine. But I do have an additional question, if I may, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure I'm getting this correct. So in Wilsonville, for example, we have a wastewater treatment plant that then discharges into the Willamette River. And for protection of fish and that sort of thing, we have to make sure that the water's a particular temperature so it's not raising the temperatures and that sort of thing. And also with regards to the clarity, which now currently you could probably actually drink the water, but a lot of people would just find it not very appetizing to put a glass into the discharge pipe. But my question is, so what this would then suggest is that if Wilsonville wanted to, instead of discharging into the Willamette River, decided that they wanted to catch that water and reuse it in some fashion within the city limits or wherever their water customers are, that they could go ahead and do that. If all the communities along the river decided to do that, would that create any kind of a problem with regards to the water, to the flows in the river?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummel, that would be, first of all, DEQ, you know, they're under permit, like every wastewater treatment plant has their permit, and it would have to be up to DEQ to review and approve still within their permit. I mean, I'm not. First of all, for instance, I know in the Tualatin Basin, which I worked for years, I mean, we needed those flows in the Tualatin to meet our minimum flows and to keep temperature at a certain level. So it would really be up to the individual permits, number one, and that would be DEQ's role to review and make sure that it was in the confines of the permit to do that. One of the things we're looking at is not just reuse of treated effluent that's coming out of a wastewater treatment plant, but the technical term is sort of gray water, and looking at dual piping systems where you could use rainwater, for just an example, rainwater to flush toilets instead of using, you know, for instance, water from the Bull Run or treated water. There's lots of different examples where sometimes existing code prohibits that from occurring. So it's not just the end of the pipe that's coming out of a municipal wastewater treatment plant, but looking at incentives for, say, developers who are building a new development to look at a dual system of gray water where you can, you know, within individual homes recirculate, or within individual developments recirculate as well. So there's lots of different options, but DEQ is well aware that, you know, they would have to review individual permits and make sure that's okay, that they're, for instance, Wilsonville is still meeting their flows in the Willamette. So I think it's really going to be decided on a case-by-case basis. The real thrust of this is to say, do we have rules and regulations in our existing statutes that prohibit developers who want to do these good things from doing it, and from individuals who want to collect rainwater and maybe use it to irrigate their own gardens from doing it? So there's all different scales that we're looking at within this legislation, but you raise an excellent point.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Jensen, seeing no Representative Butler, I wondered if you wanted to just make a couple of comments about the first half of the bill.
Certainly be very happy to, if I get the right bill in front of me here. The first half of the C-13 amendment really have to do with House Bill 3281. And House Bill 3281, allows irrigation districts to manage for one season, one irrigation season, temporarily change the point of diversion or appropriation combined with change in the place of use and change in the point of diversion to allow for appropriation of groundwater or change primary right to supplemental right. And I started out wrong on that. It should have been allowed to irrigation districts with a manager to do these things. And it further directs the Water Resource Department to establish a pilot project allowing irrigation districts to use water on any land within legal boundaries of the district for water uses subject to transfer. There is a sunset on the pilot project of 2008, and the pilot project includes irrigation districts in Representative Butler's district. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I can't. In the bill it says the Talon Irrigation District, the Oahe Irrigation District, and the Tualatin Irrigation District to do this. One of the reasons for the changes in the language in the statutes that we've had in the last couple of sessions as far as transfers are concerned is it is often necessary on kind of spur-of-the-moment sort of things for individuals to transfer their water use. For example, in the case that an individual is contracting for a crop and the contractor is like a potato processor, sees a supply oversupply of potatoes and don't wish to contract for it, it's at the very late moment that the producers get that information. And since the land that they were going to irrigate is potentially not usable that season for something else, and they want to move that water to another one of their crops under a system without the ability and flexibility we're adding to water transfers here, such use would be impossible for it.
And I note, Representative, in the bill that it in all the changes has a proviso that says, provided that the proposed transfer complies with all the provisions of the subsection and will not result in injury or enlargement of an existing water right, a district manager may, for one irrigation season, temporarily change the point of diversion. Yeah. So it seems like it's got a fair amount of protective language in it to ensure that it's for the limited purpose that you've described.
The rest of the users of the of water in the irrigation district are protected, then there can be no damage, in essence, to them. Water Resource Department is very careful about monitoring these issues.
Okay. Representative Krasanski. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Przanski had a question.
I was going to move the C-13s, but I'll wait for
that. I'll pass. That's what I was going to say.
Okay.
Brevity.
All right.
I understand why many of our non-attorney colleagues on judiciary sometimes are, find themselves lost after sitting through the presentation on water. I know why.
That's right. That's right.
Well, it only seems fair then, doesn't it, Representative Jensen?
What comes around goes around.
Yeah, that's right. Representative Jensen has moved the C-13 amendments to Senate Bill 820. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The 13s are adopted. Representative Jensen?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill or Senate Bill 820 as reamended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Jensen moves Senate Bill 820 as further amended by the C-13s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Okay, and call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Hummel?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Pazonski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Good. Aye. Senate Bill 820 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Jensen, if you'd be willing to take it again.
Yes.
All right. You'll have two more things to talk about when that bill gets to the floor.
We'll try to make it just as short as it would have been, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, let's get it to stick this time, right? This,
okay.
This last time we want to do last time on this bill. All right. Thank you. Now we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 297. Colleagues, you have another amendment being passed out to you by Patsy.
Thank God. Couldn't make it through without another one.
And you also have a sheet, which is a matrix to amendments.
The dash 20, Mr. Chair.
I feel like we've entered the matrix.
I missed the snide comment, Representative.
Here, I said, I feel like we've entered the matrix.
Yeah.
Because
what's
we
the,
have.
What's the name of that? What's the...
Reloaded.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
Matrix amended. Reloaded.
All right, so we have now an additional 820 to stick on the bottom of your chart that, Mr. Taylor, you prepared this one, is that right?
We prepared the matrix, Mr. Chairman, of the committee, but I'm totally at loss on the 820 amendments. So.
Does someone want to own up to the 820 amendments?
I will, Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
The 820s, Mr. Chair, are a substitute for the A18, so I think you can, can regard those as withdrawn, at least as to my support for them. And it really goes to the same issue, which is trying to deal with the what perceived to be the disproportionality of the defense costs in environmental litigation in relation to the indemnity limits under general liability policies. And what the A18s are, or A20s are, is a simpler approach, which is to again address the two categories of expense that are in question in the front end of remediation, that is, an investigation activities and feasibility studies. And what the A20s do is treat the investigation activities as defense costs and the feasibility study costs as indemnity costs and therefore subject to policy limits for the policy. And there's a definition of what constitutes investigation activity, and because of the late-breaking nature of these, the language here, it was not fully vetted among all the stakeholders, and some comments have been offered to me just before our meeting today about the definition, and so I think if there's an interest in pursuing the A20s, I would recommend that we get some comment on the definition of what's investigative activity from people who are present.
Okay. So this is what all of you have been waiting for over your 4th of July holiday, was the consideration of these amendments that we have in front of us. Now, the A-19, did we talk about the A-19 on Thursday?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, they're new.
They're new as well.
Right.
Okay.
The A-14, I think it's safe to say there's no objection to the A-14.
All right.
Let me ask Mr. Monroe.
who clearly didn't have the courage to wear the pants that match that jacket today.
And it begins.
That's not a good sign, is it?
I thought that was last week that we had that day.
Well, we're having, you know, I mean, I just always think it's good to wear the pants that match the jacket.
Maybe does this look too big.
Jack.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I knew that I might be put upon today, but I didn't know that it would begin with my attire. But Jack, think of me as a sportscaster sitting here with a coat tie on and a pair of tennis shorts or something.
Yeah, right. The A13s, are they superseded by the 19s, Jack?
That is correct.
Okay, so the 13s we can mark as withdrawn as well, right?
That is correct.
Okay. And do you want to tell us what you like about the 19s better than you liked about the 13s, or what you are trying to accomplish with the 19s?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I guess a little bit by way of background, because really I think what these represent in part or a partial counterpoint, if you will, to something offered up by the proponents in the A12s. But by way of background, you know, I think we've told you certainly in the hearing last Tuesday and in some private conversations that one of the problems with this measure in our judgment and the all sums allocation is that the rigid application of one formula to complex factual and legal situations is going to lead to significant unfairness in some cases and the possibility of impairing or at least raising impairment of contract arguments. Now, when the Senate discussed the issue of the subsection 4, section 2 contribution kind of formula, the Senate, I think, concluded that it would be unfair if an insured who had decided to self-insure or who had not purchased coverage that extended to pollution situations, it would be unfair if they didn't play some role in paying both the cost of indemnity and some portion of the defense costs. And so the language in Section 2, subsection 4D was placed in there. Now, frankly, I don't think that language poses a problem for us, but the proponents have come back and suggested to you in the first part of I think, A12 amendments that it ought to read as follows. If the insured failed to obtain general liability insurance for part of the time period included in the environmental claim, the insured shall be considered an insurer for the purposes of allocation. What that means is that the only time that would apply would be in a case where they had self-insured. If they had a general liability policy with a pollution exclusion, they wouldn't participate in either the allocation of defense costs or the indemnity. And we believe that's fundamentally unfair. And so the language in the A19s is offered up to make clear. I have so many pieces of paper, excuse me. Okay. That uninsured means that the insured does not have insurance that by its terms provides coverage for environmental claims. So we believe that that's an appropriate amplification of what, if an amplification is needed at all, of what is in subsection 4 sub D of the printed bill.
Okay. While you're up there, Jack, if you could comment, since you're seeing the A20s for the first time like we are, on the A20s, which were a re-approach to the A18s.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I believe that as Representative McPherson has indicated, it's apparently it's patterned after some language in the state of Washington, and it probably does clarify one area where there is some arguable uncertainty in the state of Oregon, and that is with regard to how feasibility study costs are to be treated. And to the extent that it addresses that issue and makes more certain how those are considered, we would consider it to be an improvement.
Okay. Good. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Who else wants to come up and speak to the A20s? Mr. DiLorenzo?
Thank you, Chair. I'll bring my black coat.
Yeah, it doesn't match your pants either, but that's all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John DiLorenzo on behalf of ICN Pharmaceuticals. The A20s, I think, are a good effort to attempt to differentiate remedial investigation costs from feasibility study costs. However, if I can give you just a quick example in ICN's case, ICN incurred significant remedial investigation costs, which were costs incurred to determine the nature and extent of the contamination, and I believe are appropriately designated as defense costs, because the whole purpose of the costs is to limit the ultimate exposure of the party at issue. The problem with designating all feasibility study costs as indemnity is that, first of all, you don't always know who all the insurers are off the bat when you are expending your remedial investigation costs. If it takes a while to investigate who and to determine who all the insurers are, the insurers will not pay any costs prior to tender. Of course, you cannot tender costs expended to an insurance company without knowing who the insurer happens to be. And so as you are developing your insurance chart, you may very well find that the DEQ has required you to expend massive amounts of money on remedial investigation costs, none of which are going to be ultimately recoverable against an insurer who you locate months or years later because you did not tender to those insurers in time. And so all you may be left with is the potential to recover both your indemnity and your feasibility study costs. I believe it is unfair to automatically designate feasibility study costs as defense or as indemnity, because quite often the purpose of the feasibility study is once again to limit the exposure of the party dealing with the DEQ. Here's a good case in point. When ICN was required to remediate the trichloroethylene in the groundwater, after we identified the nature and extent of the contamination, we had to enter into the feasibility study process. The feasibility study concludes with a matrix showing a variety of technologies that could be utilized in order to accomplish the task at hand, and then a matrix concerning things like risk of implementation, efficacy, cost, etc. And the whole purpose of the feasibility study is to determine what is the most efficient way to clean up at the lowest possible cost to the party who is before the DEQ. In our case, the DEQ asked us to investigate nitrogen freezing. They wanted us to pump liquid nitrogen into the ground to freeze the groundwater and then to excavate the groundwater in a solid form out of the ground. Well, the cost of that alternative would have been gigantic. We finally, one of the procedures we investigated was six-phase heating, which involves heating the groundwater, in essence boiling out the contaminants and then sucking them out of the ground through a vapor extraction system, which saved us $15 million in proposed costs. Now, it would be hard to tell me that that exercise was not designed to limit the overall exposure of the parties before the DEQ. And so I think in that case, the feasibility study was certainly more akin to defense costs than it was to indemnity. And so I would suggest that at line 12 of the amendment, you consider the following. After the words payment of the costs of a feasibility study shall be treated as, I would insert the words either defense or indemnity costs by the court as appropriate. To the extent that the court designates feasibility costs as indemnity costs, then the cost shall reduce the insurer's applicable limit. I think it is probably better policy to leave that determination up to the court as to how much of the costs incurred in the feasibility study are akin to defense, how much of them are truly indemnity, and to the extent that they're indemnity, yes, then I agree they should reduce the indemnity limits. But to the extent that they're a defense, they should be treated as other defense costs are treated under the terms of the policies. I do agree with the proponent of the A20s that that the remedial investigation is quite likely almost all defense. And the Multnomah County Circuit Court has at least treated indemnity as presumptively defense costs. So those would be my comments.
Questions from Mr. DiLorenzo about the A20s? Representative Cromwell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, Mr. DiLorenzo, you talked about the times when the feasibility study actually would still be part of the investigation versus part of the indemnity. But didn't the feasibility study in the ICN case that you were just describing still lead you or lead the agency as well as the insured to a better solution than just doing what the agency initially wanted, and therefore the feasibility was really did become, as opposed to being part of the defense, really did become part of the actual remediation or mitigation of the contamination.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, I think you make a good observation. You make my point, I think. There are components of the feasibility study, yes, that are more better characterized as indemnity. For instance, portions of the feasibility study involving the remedial design and the remedial action work plans definitely are designed to implement the ultimate technology that's chosen for the site. And in that case, I would agree with you that that's more properly characterized as indemnity. On the other hand, when you have 18 different technologies that the DEQ wants you to investigate, some of which will bankrupt your company and others of which are potentially implementable, and then when you have to weigh the efficacy of that technology versus the cost, those activities, which are also very time-consuming and very expensive, I think are more properly defense costs because those are all designed, at least by the company, to attempt to limit the company's ultimate exposure for the overall project. And they are in the same; they have the same characteristics then as the remedial investigation had. So I would say yes. Sometimes portions of the feasibility study are properly classifiable as indemnity. Sometimes they are defense. And my suggestion is, this is an area in which you should allow the court to parse out which portions were attributable to which. It's pretty. The courts can do them. These exercises. They have experience doing it. And I would have the court basically look at the characteristics of the activity and decide how to classify them. If they're defense, they should be treated as defense. If they're indemnity, they should be treated per the A20s as indemnity.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. DiLorenzo, setting aside for the moment the issue of the suggested change you would make in whether feasibility studies are treated as indemnity costs in all cases, is the definition that's used here of what is remedial investigation, as distinguished from feasibility study, as the language that's in lines 2 through 6 of the A20s. Does that look like a satisfactory reflection of what the law is of, or ought to be, of remedial investigation?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I believe in a shorthand way you pretty well state my understanding of what the purpose of a remedial investigation is. So I would say yes. There may be others in the audience who might differ, but I believe the purpose of a remedial investigation is to determine what's there, how extensive it is, and where it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative McPherson, since the 820s were your amendment, do you have any comment about the proposed additional language offered by Mr. DiLorenzo to allow the court to judge between the issue of indemnity on those
counts? Mr. Chair, it seems to me that really blunts the purpose of the amendment, and perhaps so significantly that it's not wouldn't be worth going forward with it. That is, the what's happening in this bill generally is a legislative solution is being crafted for a problem that is being addressed in other states through judge-made law. And the case that's been made for doing so is that we need faster and more certain action that would arise through court decision, and we need to do so reflecting sort of broader public policies that I would regard the legislature as being more effective at crafting than individual judges. And what this is doing, the 820, is as drafted without the change, is to resolve an issue that the parties could litigate over rather than try to resolve through legislation. And in order to try to create certainty so that we establish clearly that remedial investigation is subject to funds being advanced up front, and then create certainty for the parties, too, in the knowledge that feasibility studies will not be. So it strikes me that we're moving away from the certainty that is the purpose of the legislative effort here if we were to make that change in the 820s. But I would invite comment from Mr. DiLorenzo in response to what I just said.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I understand the need for certainty. My concern about drawing an absolute line on each side is that once the law, assuming this becomes the law, it will manipulate the behavior of parties. There will be a tendency to front-end load some expenses, to characterize them one way over another way, just to, in essence, play the game. And I would be personally very cautious about doing that. I believe that the courts can, on a fairly summary basis, determine the basic nature of certain expenses. The parties can do it either through summary judgment or through a fairly abbreviated evidentiary hearing once the expenditures have been made. All you need is someone to say yes or no. One option is either to eliminate this section and leave the current law in place where the court decides what the nature of both remedial investigation and feasibility study costs are, whether they're indemnity or defense. The other way is to say that they're presumptively one way or the other, subject to a court viewing it otherwise. That would also give some at least inkling to the parties as to the likelihood of one expenditure being characterized one way or the other. But each of these projects are so different that my personal view is that they do not warrant a strict black and white test. And if you do have one, I think you will start predetermining the conduct of parties. And instead of just deciding to, attack the problem and do what's best about cleaning up the problem, they're going to be wondering what should they do in order to maximize or minimize their coverage. And I can see a whole series of disputes brewing, especially when insurers and insureds are involved from the very beginning as to how to basically coordinate a cleanup. So, again, I apologize for just bringing my comments to the committee at this point, but I just received the amendments.
Right, as did we all.
But those are my thoughts.
All right, thank you. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Mr. Gallagher. And I assume you're going to talk to us about the A19s and the A20s?
Just the A20s, Mr. Chair. I think that's what you asked for comments on. Tom Gallagher, representing Snitzer Industry. And, let me just take a quick preliminary second here. I like the way this discussion is going. I wish we'd have entered into these types of discussions quite a bit earlier in this process, because I think we're trying to get at what's fair here. Let me put two preliminary points in. Under McCormick and Baxter, if we have an insurance company with coverage, we can recover all of these costs now. It's a question of perhaps suing them, or it's a question of sometimes them accepting liability, and these defense costs are recoverable now. So this amendment would be to change a bit of the rights that we currently have, and if we were to pursue that, we'd have to, you know, look at that in terms of what the trade-off is. The second thing is that we've consistently heard from the opponents, worthy opponents, that we were trying to rewrite the contract. And this is clearly a rewrite of the contract, which, if the committee wanted to go that way, you have a legislative prerogative to do. It wasn't a way which we thought would get us in the right direction early on. To the technical parts of the language that was offered here, in the direction that Mr. DiLorenzo was going, is not one we would reject. The presumption of rebuttability makes some sense as a way to again inject a bit of fairness into the process. But there are, in Oregon, under OARs, OAR 340-122-0050 lists out in Oregon the activities. I don't have that OAR in front of me. Joan has it on her BlackBerry, which, through the miracles of modern technology, we can get pieces of it, but not all of it, and it won't print out. But there are a list of five or six elements of what are the defense under Oregon administrative law, and they include risk assessment and preliminary assessment as part of the remedial investigation. The question I would have, and I don't know the answer to, is whether under their six, their A, B, and C, as Mr. DiLorenzo said, actually covers all of these elements of the Oregon OAR. I think that getting to yes on the definition of remedial investigation is very possible very quickly. I'm not so sure that the dash 20s do it. They raise questions in our mind as to would we have to go back in and get some interpretation from this court as to what these three new elements in Oregon law meant. And secondly, that we would have raised the point that Mr. DiLorenzo did under treatability studies that could be mandated by the Department of Environmental Quality as to whether they were part of the feasibility study or part of the ultimate defense costs. Joan would be happy to answer any questions or give additional thoughts on this if you wanted them.
Okay, are there questions for either Mr. Gallagher or Ms. Snyder? Representative
Pearson. Okay, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on what Mr. Gallagher was saying. We have a definition here that was provided to me for purposes of the A20s that I have no particular background with, and apparently there are other definitions that we think there's an OAR in Oregon that already addresses the same issue and addresses it in different terms. And so it may be that this amendment doesn't maybe cover the ground it needs to cover because we don't have that source available to us. If we were to plug in such a definition, one that reflects what is current law, would this amendment, as otherwise crafted, be a positive addition to the discussion in this area?
Okay, let me try that. I'm Joan Snyder. I'm a lawyer with Stoll Reeves, and I'm here representing Snitzer. And Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson and other representatives, I can respond to that. I guess I need to start out by saying that my client is not in support of this amendment, but answering the theoretical question of could something be structured is what I hear you saying, that uses Oregon definitions that meets the same goal of fairness and certainty, two things I heard you say. I think the answer is you could do it in a presumptive way, which is what Mr. DiLorenzo has suggested, and I think that's actually a good idea. And here's, for instance, this rule only breaks things down into remedial investigation and feasibility studies. As Mr. Gallagher said, there's actually five components that are listed in the DEQ statute of the things they will require you to do once you enter into this process. The first one is the preliminary assessment. The second one is the risks remedial investigation, the RI, which is what is here. Then the third one is the risk assessment, which the rules treat as part of the remedial investigation when they define remedial investigation. Then the fourth component would be the feasibility study, and that may or may not include the kind of treatability study that Mr. DiLorenzo talked about with the investigating the injection of liquid nitrogen. So, structurally, yes, it could be done. We could take the components of the DEQ regulations and use those instead of these two definitions that are in the A20 as it sits right now. In terms of how it's done, I guess I would like to just refer to how Judge Keyes handled this in the Zeidel case. And what he said is this is in accord with what Mr. DiLorenzo said, if what you're doing is to design to reduce your ultimate liability, you're still defining what this remedy is that the agency is going to make you implement. If you're defining that remedy in a way that's limiting your liability, then that's defense. And if you're designing the remedy or going to what Representative Kremel suggested, you're actually in the process, you're already on the path of moving toward implementing the remedy, then that's essentially what Judge Keyes said was a feasibility study. I agree with Mr. DiLorenzo that has to be called on a case-by-case basis. But if the statute said, presumptively, the preliminary assessment, the remedial investigation, and the risk assessment, and any treatability study component of the feasibility study are going to be defense cost, and remedial design and alternatives analysis are going to be treated as feasibility study and indemnity, and we made it a presumption, you would still allow the courts to come in on a case-by-case basis and do the kind of thing that Judge Keyes did. So that's sort of a long-winded answer, but I think the answer to your question is yes, it could be done. It will be done differently than this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. While you're there, do you want to comment, since the 19s were new and no one got to comment on the 19s? I know they're a rehash of the 13s, but it does use a little bit different language. Did you have a comment on the 19s?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The 19s do what the previous amendments do, is they seem to cover that time period for which the party was self-insured or did not have insurance. Let me again say, and I hope all of you keep this in the forefront of your deliberations, when our opponents talk about going outside of the policy, if I refer you to page 2 of the bill on line 34, none of the amendments we're talking about or none of the elements of the bill we're talking about apply on line 34 outside of pursuant to the applicable terms of the policy. The applicable terms of the policy take precedent over anything that we're doing. And so to go in and argue that somebody may have a general liability policy, but it has an exclusionary clause in it, that controls. The language to me, if it needs to be clearer, I leave that to the members of this committee, that is not covered. What we say in our A12 amendments is that if it is not excluded in the policy, then if you bought a general liability insurance, did not buy a general liability insurance policy, or bought one that did not cover pollution, you are self-insured. The difference between their language and our language is the post-1985 and the calculations as to whether or not all of the time period after all these exclusions went into effect would be calculated back into our share of the risk. And that would be patently unfair, because we're talking about provisions and policies that were in effect and deciding on the terms of those provisions and policies. So we don't like 19. We think that R12 covers this. Thank you.
Thank you. Council?
Chair, Mr. Gallagher, I assume you have that language in there because it recognizes the constitutional restrictions in this area?
Mr. Chair, Council Taylor, I never thought of that.
I see a council going yes.
Yes.
Okay. You're on the edge of your seat. Mr. Monroe, come forward.
I guess just a couple of comments. In this discussion, obviously the A20 amendments was very interesting, certainly interesting. For the record, I'm Jack Monroe, representing the American Insurance Association. Certainly interesting because the basic plea there was you ought to leave it up to the courts to deal with issues depending upon the factual situations of each of the of a specific situation, which is exactly the point that we've been making with you on the allocation issue, which is that you have widely varying factual and legal situations, and you ought not select one allocation formula to apply to all of those situations. So the argument's the same. As it relates to the A19s, I'm not certain that I was able to piece together Mr. Gallagher's comments, but again, as it relates to allocation, whether we're talking about pre-85 or post-85, the fact of the matter is if the insured, self-insured, or didn't have coverage that was designed to cover pollution occurrences, then they ought to participate in the allocation of indemnity costs and defense costs. I think a little background is appropriate here. Even in those pre-85 CGL policies, comprehensive general liability policies, there was a pollution exclusion. It excluded soot and acid and alkali and a whole series of other related incidences. What it had in there was a provision that said it would cover sudden and accidental events. The McCormick and Baxter case gave that phrase, sudden and accidental, new elastic meaning. It was represented, I think, on Thursday that pollution coverage was not available immediately after 1985, and 85 was a key date because insurance policies, or at least CGL policies, contained what people thought and maybe still think to be an absolute pollution exclusion. But pollution coverage was available after that provision went into the CGL policies. But again, I think the issue to focus on is that if you're uninsured or if you bought a general liability policy that doesn't cover pollution and you later want to come back and say, the insurance company ought to be jointly and severally liable for all of the indemnity costs up to the limit and all of the defense costs, the insured ought to participate for that portion of the time when they either didn't have adequate insurance or were self-insured.
Okay. Thank you, Jack. Are there questions about those comments?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Sherrill.
I'm kind of reflecting on the suggestion that the argument against the A20s that the court should have flexibility determining whether to apply feasibility costs as either indemnity or cost of defense sort of does support, I think, supports the rationale of the A8s, doesn't it? That says that the court should determine the all sums or the pro rata based on the facts and whichever applies most closely to the policy. Just an observation. I might be interested in having someone distinguish those two for me if I'm hearing that wrong.
Well, I think that was the point that Mr. Monroe was making in his case.
Wasn't this 8-8 considered to be status quo? As to which
right. Yeah, the 8-8s essentially would just leave things as they are.
Mr. Chair, Representative Persansky, I think that might be. I think on Thursday we indicated. I think in reality, and I think Mr. Barrett is with me. We could tell you there are variations on the theme that may be precluded by the language that's here.
My recollection is Mr. Baird did indicate that there are other allocation methods besides pro rata or all sums, and that this would limit it to just those two. But I think it's also true, isn't it, Mr. Barrett, that those are usually the two most common arguments that are made for allocation among parties?
Mr. Chair, committee members, that would be generally accurate in some cases, Mr. Chair. In other cases, the allocation by limits is also a very commonly advanced allocation scheme, so I would add the allocation by limits is one of the methods that would be eliminated.
Okay. All right. Thank you both very much. Is there anybody else who has just a burning desire to get up and say something? Tom?
Bird's gone, my colleagues.
Mr. Chair, I'd just say two things in response to Jack. We were responding to Lana Butterfield's insurance language, which is identified as A20s, where we talked about bringing the court back in because it changes the terms of the policies, and the language doesn't quite fit on all fours with Oregon law. That doesn't meet the original argument here that we don't want to go to court. We want to settle these things. It's apples and oranges argument to come back up. We didn't raise changing the contract, and we didn't raise these other issues. So I think you're left here with the decision of does our engrossed language on all sums with the amendments 12, 14, and the others, move this process forward. If we could reach some sort of an agreement on the A20 amendments that worked under Oregon law, that's a whole change and a whole compromise, which we'd be willing to come forward and pursue as a compromise. I'm anxious for the insurance companies to do the same thing. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yep, don't go away. You have a question.
I just want to try this one on the A20s and maybe invite comment from the committee, too. It seems to me that if we have a bill directing that feasibility costs will be allocated in one direction and investigation costs in another, it seems to me we're going to end up with A20 anyway, because there's going to be questions of fact always between these two categories that, of course, we're going to have to sort out. So does it make any difference whether we, doesn't that sort of say that the A20s are providing the most logical approach, the most imminent approach?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackman, my understanding of the way that the current status of the law is under McCormick and Baxter, if the insurance company accepts coverage, all the defense costs, including the feasibility study costs, are covered costs. Those will be argued over. And in our original bill, we had a provision in there to try to begin to allocate which defense costs get paid and don't get paid. So I think, yes, I think that's, again, one of the other objections or the points of contention in the interpretation of these policies. We dropped the defense cost language out as in moving toward compromise on this. It's come back in, I think, in a legitimate way. I think it's come back in as part of the bigger problem. I have no objections to dealing with it. But, again, this committee gets thrown in on the last day in fairly complicated waters, in which everybody who sits out here has access to information that you don't have and attempts to parse it out. So the answer to your question shortly is I think there will be litigation over some of these defense costs as to whether they're appropriate with or without A20. A20 was an attempt, I think, to deal with a method of solving the problem of all sums, which the insurance companies don't like. And remember, the difference between all sums and pro rata is basically who has to litigate against whom. Ultimately, the liability is still going to be there under McCormick and Baxter based on the terms of the policy. And ultimately, somebody's going to have to do this. The all sums language is not yet Oregon Supreme Court. It may not be. The Oregon Supreme Court may adapt pro rata, but it will do it in a different form than this. We've brought forward all sums. They have never really proposed all rata. They just pro rata in any way that the courts would. They propose an A8 amendment, which is a slightly truncated way of doing pro rata. I know that this answer is fairly complicated, but I think that if you pursue A20, A20 could get us to a fairer conclusion with some drafting to it. If you don't pursue A20, we'd be in roughly the same situation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative
Brzezinski.
Instead of the musical chairs, I'm wondering if we just bring everyone up, give them one last shot through this, and then
well, it's actually sort of fun to watch. Depending on what somebody says, somebody else gets up and down.
Easy like the budget.
Yeah, right. Yeah, truly. Here's what I'm going to do. It looks like I got a lineup on that table. Is that right, John? Are you there to talk? All right. Lana, are you there to talk or just to give John moral support? If you want, you're welcome to. Mark, are you there to talk?
No.
All right. Go ahead, Lon.
Mr. Chair, for the record, members of the committee, I'm Lana Butterfield, here representing Safeco Insurance Company, and we've been working with Representative McPherson on the A20s, and this is something we would like to have in this bill. It maybe could be parsed out in a conference committee if there are some adjustments that needed to be made, but I know that the A20s are important to my company.
Yes, thank you for putting
before
that
on
a question.
Yes. Regarding some of the changes that have been suggested for the A20, such as making it presumptive, is that a position that your client would support?
I've been on the phone to them all day, and I haven't asked them that particular question, but I think that they would.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Nelson and then Mr. DiLorenzo.
Mr. Chairman, Mark Nelson representing Oregon Metals Industry Council. I just want to emphasize that 297, as it came over to you, we believe did not change the contract. They both set out a process by which we believe we can move these issues forward. One of the amendments, which hasn't been discussed today, was discussed the other day, is Dash 17. I believe 18 and 20 could be construed, and 20 is changing the contract. Dash 17, we believed, was an effort on our part to try to address a legitimate issue, and that is the allocation of cost, of defense cost, for a period of time that someone was uninsured. So in the Dash 17, which we believe is, I believe, I should say, is as far as you should go as opposed to 18s or 20s, where it says if an insured failed to obtain general liability insurance, an insurer who otherwise has an obligation to pay defense costs may deny that portion of defense costs that would be allocated to the insured under subsection 4 of this section. We believe that doesn't change the contract and that this is a step forward to try to meet one of the insurer's objections, as has been emphasized by Mr. Monroe, and I think it does, without going to the extent the Dash 20 moves towards. So we would support, I would support Dash 17 over 18 or 20.
Okay, thank you. Mr. DiLorenzo.
Mr. Chairman, John DiLorenzo on behalf of ICN Pharmaceuticals. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to answer directly Representative Ackerman's question and then propose another way to resolve what I see as some of the competing interests here. First of all, the DEQ has a distinct delineation between a remedial investigation in its administrative rules and a feasibility study. And so if an expense is incurred while the remedial investigation is underway, which is that giant scoping exercise, before the feasibility study has started, there is no way, in my view, to argue that the expenditure should better have been characterized as part of the feasibility study. If you draw a complete black and white line, you're stuck with every, as an insured, with every single expenditure that has been made during one period or the other, and they're going to be characterized accordingly. My suggestion, and I am very mindful of Representative McPherson's interest here in trying to establish some kind of direction for the parties and some predictability. My suggestion is at lines 9 and at lines 12, prior to the wording of each of those sentences, you insert the words, quote, "it shall be a rebuttable presumption that." If you say it shall be a rebuttable presumption that the costs of remedial investigation are treated as defense, and if you then said at line 12, it shall be a rebuttable presumption that payment of the cost of the feasibility study is treated as indemnity, What you would do is you would provide for parties, I think, the type of predictability that Representative McPherson is seeking, and yet, in a circumstance like the one I outlined for ICN, you would provide the opportunity to go into court and rebut the presumption to show that some of the expenditure that was made on the feasibility study really was for the purpose of diminishing the overall exposure of the insured. I think that would probably be, at least in my opinion, and I haven't reviewed this with anyone, of course, I just came up with it, but it would be, in my opinion, a way of resolving Representative McPherson's interests without disadvantaging a client who, like ICN in our position. So you can think about that as a manner of resolution. I would offer that.
Okay. More choices, just what this committee needs. Okay.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. I know you were trying to be helpful. I didn't mean that in a negative way.
Mr. Chairman, my name is David Crang. I represent insurers in environmental insurance recovery actions. At my prior job, I also represented insurers in such actions. At the present time, there are pending cases that are on the appellate court's dockets that will decide the issues that are before this committee. And I think the debate that has transpired just in the last few moments has made it clear how complex most of these issues can become and why the courts are specially suited to decide these issues with all of the facts, the insurance policies, and the various options available to the courts to decide what allocation methods should be used and what laws should be applied to the proof of lost or missing insurance policies. Currently, I have a case pending against the Schnitzer Company, and there are also cases on appeal by Cascade and Seidel Company, and it's very clear that this effort in front of this body is to essentially prevent the Court of Appeals from deciding those issues. It's our position that the courts are uniquely situated with all of those facts and all of the information to decide those issues. Now, just in the last few moments, there have been discussions about the various options available to you in this legislation and to the courts to allocate between defense and indemnity expenses. And the proposal has been made by Mr. DiLorenzo that the court be given discretion to do that. And I want to show the members of this body how unfair this legislation can be by use of a specific example that is not a hypothetical. ICN's case in the trial courts is still pending. My client and other clients settled, other carriers settled with ICN, and there's only one carrier left in the case. I'm sure if this legislation passes that ICN will ask that insurance carrier to pay all of its remedial investigation and feasibility costs, which could be up to $8 to $10 million. The carrier that's left in that case has a $1 million policy, to my recollection. This is indicative of how unfair this legislation could be. It's my position that the courts, when hearing that prospect, would be better suited to allocate among the carriers who have settled in for years where there was already coverage, and to the insured who's left in the case, without having the unfortunate, I think, unfair result with one carrier left paying a full cleanup bill while the other carriers have settled. The carriers who have settled should be protected from contribution. We believe that. My client would believe that. I'm not here on behalf of that client, but we believe that that provision of the legislation, if this is to pass, should be included. But the legislation itself could serve to be entirely unfair to that one insurance carrier who has not settled. That is a specific example and not a hypothetical of how this legislation could act. Are there any questions?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, colleagues, this is, and I hope the parties feel as if they have gotten an opportunity. I think the committee's been very interested in hearing both sides of what is clearly a complicated issue. I think there is debates in particular cases that could get argued in front of the committee ad infinitum. I think there are arguments that could be made as to why the committee or the legislature should weigh in on this issue, and arguments to be made why the legislature perhaps ought not to weigh in on this issue. And I think both of them have a certain degree of merit. But we have a bill in front of us that this committee has now heard a fair amount of detail about, and we have a series of amendments in front of us put forward by varying sides, and there comes a point, and this is it, where it's time for us to stop the talking and decide what we're going to do with this bill so we can move on, and that is the point I believe we are at committee. So with that, I will use the euphemism of we are in work session to signal to committee members that we are prepared to address the amendments or not address the amendments of this bill as the committee sees fit. Representative Ackerman.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that the Dash 12 amendments be incorporated into Senate Bill 297A.
Representative Ackerman has moved the Dash A12 amendments to 297A. Those were discussed in Thursday's meeting. If you want to look at your cheat sheet, there's a brief description. Is there discussion of the Dash A12 amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shadow.
If we were to adopt the Dash A19s, would they be considered to amend the A12s if we were to adopt both?
Representative Shetterly, I think that if you adopt the Dash A12s, which defines the term uninsured or replaces the term is self-insured or uninsured with particular language, and then you adopt the A19s, you would essentially be amending the language that was adopted by the A12s.
Well, but I guess my question is that since they're not entirely at odds, are they? I'm looking at the cheat sheet.
It's definitional, counsel.
They don't amend the same lines, but I'm not going to address the issue of whether they're, in fact, there's a policy consistent with each other.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm looking at is the matrix.
Right.
Reloaded. Deletes from an insured choice factors in determining which insurance company to sue. Then language, any other factors that the insured considers appropriate. Now, that language is not at issue or addressed by the A19s. So I guess my question was, if the committee were to adopt the A12s and the A19s, would you have that aspect of the A12s
Mr. Chairman, once again, they're not amending the same lines.
Okay.
But what the A19 does is at the end of line 24, the A12s on that particular page, page 3, they delete line 4, then line 23, delete is insured or uninsured, and insert fails to obtain general liability insurance. And then what you would have, that's in line 23, and then by the 19s, on the next line, we'd add, for the purposes of this paragraph, uninsured means that the insured does not have the insurance that by its terms provide coverage for environmental claims. So we are removing or uninsured to fail to obtain general liability insurance. I assume that have to, just looking at this quickly, remember I've seen the 19 for the first time myself.
So what we're doing is we're inserting 12s which delete the term uninsured,
right. Yeah.
And then we're giving a definition to what uninsured means.
They don't work with
they don't work with the 12s. Any further discussion on Representative Ackerman's motion on the Dash A12s? All right. We're going to vote. Call the roll, Ann.
Representative Bartlett?
I'm
going to, if I may for the record, I'm going to vote no because I'm very confused by a bill that has 20 amendments, and I don't want to put something in law that I'm not sure what I'm doing, so I'm going to vote no.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Cromwell?
No.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Pazanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
I'll vote aye, but Mr. Chair, I'd like to come back and somehow get the 19 concept of the 19s back into this.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Nay.
That was a nay, Representative.
No.
Chair Williams?
Aye.
6-3.
The A-12s are in the bill. Representative Anderson.
I'm not sure whether this is procedurally correct, but I think I, like Representative Barker, feel that there's a lot more that needs to be done on this. We've seen just the last few minutes that there's a lot of discussion on the 12s, the 19s, the 20s. There are some cases in the court that may add light to this, and so I would like to move the A-16s, which I understand could probably change the whole nature of the A-12, A-19 discussion.
Okay, the A-16s were offered on Thursday by Representative Butler. If you can find them in front of you, they create a task force. I think if they were adopted, they would essentially gut the bill in its entirety and replace the bill and create a task force. Representative Anderson has moved that amendment. Is there, of the A-16s, is there discussion? Okay. Call the roll, Ann.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Representative Cromwell?
No.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Representative Pazanski?
No.
Representative Shetterly?
No.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
No.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Yes.
Chair Williams?
No. The A-16s have failed to be adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Jensen.
Just the explanation of my vote on that. That is not a vote that is based on the fact that I think I understand everything about what we're doing here.
Hear, hear. All right. Thank you, Representative Jensen, for that.
Back to reality.
Unanimous.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll move the dash A-14 amendments into Senate Bill 297A.
And the A-14 amendments, colleagues, are offered by the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and my understanding is there is no objection on the A-14 amendments.
That's the no-brainer one.
All right. So the motion is to adopt the A-14 amendments. Do I need to call the roll on this one? Is there any objection to the A-14s? All right. The A-14s are in the bill. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash 6 amendments into Senate Bill 297A.
All right, the dash A-6 amendments were amendments were offered by Mr. DiLorenzo on Thursday, and the shorthand version is that they would not permit an insurance company that failed to reach a settlement with its insured to seek contribution from an insurance company that did reach a settlement with the insured prior to the effective date of the bill, as described. And those amendments are in front of you. Discussion. Call the roll on the A6s, Ann.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Cromwell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Pazanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. The A-6s are adopted. Representative Shetterly.
Well, here's conceptually what I think I'd like to do in looking at this, trying to marry the 19s with the 12s, and it may require either a reconsideration of the vote by which we approve the A-12s or a subsequent motion to conceptually amend them, and that would be on line 5 of the 12s. Well, I guess to delete lines 5 and 6 of the 12s. That leaves in the concept self-insured or uninsured, which then would allow us to move in the A19s. And I'm sorry I wasn't fast enough as we were going through that to see that as the option. I think Mr. Monroe made the point that the distinction between general liability insurance that does or does not cover environmental claims, not that that was a valid point, that is addressed by the A19s. And if we were to leave in that language, self-insured or uninsured, that is proposed to be deleted on line 5 of, 12, of the dash 12s, that would give us the opening to amend in the A19s, and I think they would work together then.
Okay. Representative Shirley, do you want to talk us through specifically then? Representative Shetterly moves that the committee reconsider the vote by which it passed the A12 amendments for purposes of considering a conceptual amendment.
Do you need that, or do you want to, before, since the we haven't moved the bill, can we conceptually amend the 12s even as they're in? I'll do it either way. It'd be like conceptually amending the bill, I suppose.
Either way, that's fine.
Reconsideration.
All right, then let's do that. Representative Shirley moves to conceptually amend the Dash A12 amendments, which have been adopted and are part of the bill, and to your motion specifically, Representative.
Well, again, Mr. Chair, it would be to delete lines 5 and 6 of the A12 amendments with the understanding that my purpose in that would be to leave open the option to move in the A19 amendments that would define uninsured as proposed by Mr. Monroe in his testimony today.
So if you deleted lines 5 and 6 of the A12 amendments, then the language on line 23 of the bill would stay as it is. Mm-hmm. And at that point, where would you intend to insert?
Well, the A19s...
On page 3.
The A19s would be on line 24 that just further define uninsured.
Okay. So the motion then is to delete lines 5 and 6 of the A12 amendments conceptually. Is there a discussion on the motion, Representative Przanski?
I was wondering if Representative Shirley would walk us through as to why we would make that change as to what we're going to accomplish. So we just, I want to set the record.
Well, I think what I heard from Mr. Monroe was that you could have somebody who didn't have a... who had a general liability policy but an environmental exclusion that would not be considered uninsured under this language because they would not have failed to obtain a general liability policy. It seems to me if they've obtained a general liability policy that had an express environmental exclusion, they ought to be treated as uninsured for an environmental claim.
All right. So the motion then is to strike lines 5 and 6 of the Dash A12 amendments conceptually. Is there discussion? Call the roll on that motion, Ann.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Przanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Okay, the A12 has been amended then with the striking of lines 5 and 6. Representative Shetterly.
Mr. Chair, move the Dash A19s into Senate Bill 297.
Representative Shetterly moves the Dash A19 amendments into House Bill 297. To your motion.
I think I've said it. That just now that we've reinserted uninsured, this would amend into the bill this definition of uninsured that is more particular as to coverage for environmental claims.
Discussion? Representative Przanski.
Again, for the record, what I'm hearing Representative Shirley is by doing this, we're going to take care of potential void of people who have a general policy with an exclusion written into their policy for environmental issues.
And that for under this language, then, is my understanding, they would be treated as uninsured, having insured without that environmental coverage.
Okay.
Okay. The motion then is to adopt the Dash A19 amendments. Call the roll.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Przanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Mr. Chair, the A19 is in. Representative McPherson?
I move the A17s into the bill.
Representative McPherson makes a motion to adopt the Dash A17 amendments. To your motion.
Well, this.
Is it 17?
Yeah, A17 is the amendment that really just sort of.
But it also deletes the term is self-insured or uninsured.
Yeah. Ah.
Mm. So it's sort of undoing what we just did.
What I'm trying to accomplish is that with that which is in lines 5 through 10, yeah, I wasn't focusing on that then, piece of it.
Then if you wish, Representative, to conceptually amend the A-17s by striking lines 1 through 4 of the bill, you can, the amendment, you can try that.
Mr. Chair, I move that we conceptually amend the A-17s by striking lines 1 through 4. And the purpose of the A-17s, in fact, the purpose in which they were offered up to begin with, in my mind at least, was to establish the procedural rule that's set out in lines 6 through 9 of the amendment, which is that there's no obligation for the insurer to front costs for those uninsured portions of the history that a policyholder has, and they could, in effect, the property owner would then be obligated to pick up those costs at the front end, their ratable share based on the portion of time in which they are uninsured, as I've now defined in the language that was in the A-12 and A-19s.
Okay, then Representative McPherson moves to strike lines 1 through 4 conceptually of the A-17 amendments. Is there any further discussion? Any objection?
Chair.
Representative Jensen.
I suppose counsel, or in rewriting this, will take this into consideration, but line 24 is going to be changed with the addition, where it appears is going to be changed with the addition of the A-19s. Mm-hmm. So it actually is inserting it after the A-19s, is that mm-hmm. correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. All right, so the motion is to strike lines 1 through 4. Any further discussion? Is there any objection to that motion? All right. So they've been stricken.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, there's a further conceptual amendment necessary in the text that has just been brought to my attention. We have now an inconsistency in the language of lines 6 and 7, or actually line 6 in the A-17s with the language that we put into the bill through the A-19s. That is, the language does not have insurance that by its terms provides coverage for environmental claims. And so I move that we conceptually amend the A-17s further by striking the phrase failed to obtain general liability insurance and inserting in its place the phrase does not have insurance that by its terms provides coverage for environmental claims, that being the same phrase that was in the A-19s.
Representative McPherson has so moved that conceptual amendment to the dash A-17s.
Can you repeat it, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, it's the same language as in
the same language as in the A-19s.
Mr. Chair.
So help me again understand.
Okay. He's striking the language out of A-17 on line 6, where it says failed to obtain general liability insurance, and he is inserting the language that says
does not have insurance that by its terms provides coverage for environmental claims.
Right. So essentially lines 3 and 4 of the A-19s, right, to make them consistent.
Right.
And the overall effect of doing that again
the purpose of the A-17s is to establish that where there is not insurance protection in place for some portion of the history of ownership of the property, that owner is responsible for fronting the defense costs along with the insurers. And this is simply conceptually amending this language so it is consistent with what was done in the other amendments we made as to the concept of what it means to not have insurance. and that is it means not having insurance that provides coverage for environmental claims.
Okay, so that's the motion, second motion to conceptually amend the A-17s. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? All right, the conceptual amendment has been made. Representative McPherson.
Mr. Chair, I move the A-17s as conceptually amended to the into the bill.
Representative McPherson moves the A-17s as conceptually amended into House Bill 297. Discussion? Is there any objection on the A-17s as conceptually amended? Any objections? All right, the A-17s are in the bill. So, colleagues, as I read it now, we have adopted the A-6s, the A-12s, the A-17s as conceptually amended, and the A-19s, and we've, oh, I'm sorry, the A-14s and the A-19s, and we conceptually amended the A-12s so the A-19s would fit.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I figure it can't get any worse.
So oh, it
I'm
can.
Wondering.
Yeah,
well, probably can. I'll see if I can test that the boundaries here. I move that we conceptually amend the A-20s with the language that was proposed by Mr. DiLorenzo by inserting on lines 9 and on line 12, after A and B respectively, the phrase, "It shall be a rebuttable presumption that."
So the language would be inserted on line 9 after the 5A, and then again on line, where else?
12. 12, right after the B.
Right after the B. And the language you're intending to insert in those two places is, "It shall be a rebuttable presumption that." Okay, so Representative McPherson has made the motion to conceptually amend the A-20 amendments, inserting the language, "It shall be a rebuttable presumption that," on line 9 after the sub A and on line 12 after the sub B. Is there any discussion on that motion? Is there any objection? All right, they're in.
Mr. Chair, I move the A-20s as conceptually amended into the bill.
Representative McPherson moves the A-20 amendments as conceptually amended into the bill. Further discussion? Any objection? A-20s are in.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will move Senate Bill 297A as amended in these proceedings be forwarded to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves Senate Bill 297 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Call the roll.
Representative Barker? For reasons I stated earlier, I'm going to vote a soft no on this one.
Representative Jensen?
I'll vote a very soft yes on this one.
Representative Hummel?
I'll vote a soft yes to the floor.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Pazoski?
Aye.
Representative Shedd?
I'll vote a soft yes.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Yes.
Chair Williams?
Softness here.
Votes aye. House Bill 297 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I've asked Representative Ackerman to carry the bill, and he has agreed.
Don't find me to the conference committee.
And with that, colleagues, we are adjourned.
Can't afford a conference.